There are plenty of things we know here on the 20-minute hit this week. We know who's going to be in the Super Bowl in 2 weeks' time. We know who's in the Australian Open semi-finals in both the men's and women's draws. And we know that Dele Alli has really made his mark on the Premier League this season. We're going to find out what we don't know, though, about all the major topics from the last 7 days in the sporting world. I'm Ollie Wilson, commentator and reporter for BT Sport, TalkSport and various outlets around the world. As always, bringing you the 20-minute hit, and I'm joined once again by my esteemed guest and co-host, the Right Honourable Gentleman, Mr. Paul McDonald. Paul, a pleasure to speak to you once again this week, mate. How are you doing? What's caught your eye in the sporting news this week?
Some fantastic NFL action over the weekend and some less than fantastic Premier League action. So, two ends of the spectrum there.
Yeah, a few bits of ups and downs when it comes to the Premier League. We'll be diving into that a little later on the show. We do have an NFL expert in our midst here today on the 20-minute hit. Mr. Sal Capaccio, Buffalo Bills sideline reporter and play-by-play announcer for ESPN3 and Time Warner, joining us on the show today. Sal, mate, how you doing?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me on. Love being across the pond.
You enjoyed your time in London, I hope, when you're over here with the Bills earlier this season. We're also joined by an expert in all things sport, of course. He's making his hat-trick appearance here on the show. Mr. Football at Yahoo Sport himself, Mr. Christian Hennage. Christian, how you doing, mate?
I'm not too bad, thanks, mate. How are you?
I'm very well. Very well indeed, as always. Eager to dive into our first topic of the day. And, of course, it's going to be the NFL Championship games that we saw on the weekend. The AFC and NFC candidates for the Super Bowl are set. Denver putting the beat down on New England with that 20-18 win, and then an embarrassing result for the Arizona Cardinals as they were thumped by the Carolina Panthers 49-15. Sal, I'm going to start with you because you're our man for all things NFL. This Denver defense really flexed their muscles on Tom Brady. We have not seen Brady take a beating like that in a very long time in the AFC Championship game.
No, right. I think he was hit the most times he's been hit ever in a game, 23, counting knockdowns, sacks, things like that. But really, guys, I think what you're seeing here is the Broncos' blueprint for trying to win a championship is pretty much the opposite of what it's taken, I should say, to win a championship over the last several years. It's been all about the quarterback in the NFL. It's a passing league. The best quarterbacks win championships. Now, of course, by name, Peyton Manning is one of the greatest all time. But by play, he's just not anymore. He's more of a game manager. This is a Broncos team that's relying on defense, as you just brought up. They are trying to win a championship relying on their defense, not their quarterback. And that's just not the way it's done this nowadays in the NFL, which is really surprising. And I think it's fun to watch because it's going against the grain.
But these are two sides that both have exceptional defenses going into the Super Bowl, because Carolina Panthers, I think, ranked fifth in the league. The Denver defense, of course, ranked first in the NFL. It's showing still that regardless of what you talk about a passing league, defense does win championship, while offense, you know, it sells the season tickets, if you will.
Well, I think that I would challenge that these days in the NFL. You know, if you go back and look at the most of the teams that have won the championships, it's teams that have mediocre defenses lately. Since about maybe the 2003 or 4 era, it's all been quarterbacks. Brady, Manning, Roethlisberger, Breeze, Rodgers. That's who it is. And all of those teams, every once in a while, they have a really good defense to complement them. But to be honest with you, a lot of the defenses that have won championships in that era have really just been kind of mediocre. So I would say that's really all about the quarterback these days, but I don't think you can win a championship with a bad defense. I think it at least has to be good enough to allow you to get out of bad spots. But here in this case, winning with just the defense and then a game manager quarterback just isn't something we've seen in this league. You're right about Carolina, though, Juice. I mean, Carolina is a really good defense as well. Their front seven is as talented as anyone out there. They really get after you. But the thing that they have on the other side, they have Cam Newton, and he is dynamic. He is terrific. And if he wins this one early in his career, he's a made man the rest of his career. If you get that Super Bowl win early in your career, the rest of your career, you can just coast as far as your legacy.
The Panthers, this scary, almost triple threat offense, if you will, with Newton able to run, pass, Jonathan Stewart as well, and a talented, although young, receiver core too.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, they are very, very talented on offense, but really it starts with the quarterback. Here's the thing. Remember early in the season, I don't know if you guys remember this, but they had a very good wide receiver, had a good rookie year last year, Kelvin Benjamin, and he tore his ACL before the season started. And everyone said, wow, who are they going to throw to? They have nobody. I mean, come on, Ted Ginn Jr., he's on like his fourth team. You know, Greg Olsen's a nice tight end, but they don't have any wide receivers. Well, Devin Funchess winds up stepping up for this team. They have some guys that just have been good complementary type players that have done an excellent job. So they're very talented on offense, but really it's all about the quarterback on offense with them. Cam Newton is just one heck of a football player.
Now we've got the Pro Bowl to get through, which everybody doesn't seem to even want to be involved in at the moment in the NFL. But very quickly, one word each. Who are we going for to win the Super Bowl in 2 weeks' time at this point?
I want to root for Peyton Manning and have him ride off into the sunset on a win.
Paul, what about yourself?
I want to see Panthers. I think I want to see Cam Newton do it, to be honest.
And what about you, Mr. Hennage?
I think football will be the winner, Ollie. I really do.
too cliche.
And I also have to get in. I take it Tom Brady was left deflated after that defeat.
Oh my goodness.
Hey, you can't go wrong with this one, though, guys. I think this is one Super Bowl where there's no real villain, if you get my point. You know, I think that's pretty cool.
We do have a villain in the NBA to some people after Cleveland general manager David Griffin firing David Blatt as head coach this week. Sal, I want to start this off with you because this has been making the rounds in the NBA quite a bit. The Cavs are 31-12 side, top of the Eastern Conference right now, yet Blatt still not doing enough to keep his job this season. What's all this about?
Yeah, it's really interesting. I mean, can you imagine? I mean, think about if a team in another sport even goes to their championship and then the next year is basically has the best or second best, you know, record, the best record in the entire conference, and they fire their head coach. That's crazy, right? It just goes to show you how much power I think LeBron James has. And it doesn't mean that he went to the ownership and said, I want to change. But clearly there was a disconnect between the team's superstar best player, one of the best players on the planet, maybe the best, you know, other than Steph Curry, and what's going on with the coach. There was a disconnect there. The locker room didn't feel right, and I think that's why they did this. But here's the thing. Look, I mean, they felt, and I give them credit at least for thinking this way. I don't know if I would have made this move. That's, it takes a lot to do that. But they said, look, we can be the best team in the conference, but we want to win a championship, and we don't think with our style of play and this coach and the position he's putting us in is going to beat a team in the West with the way they play and who we're going to face coming out of it. What have they done since they made the switch to Tyronn Lue? They're an up-tempo team. They're running more. They're getting out in transition more. And I think that's the kind of style they want to play that they feel they can match up best in the West. This is about trying to win a championship.
Has Blatt been hard done by in that he was brought in to perhaps mastermind a 3-4 year project and then Cleveland bring back LeBron James, and suddenly Blatt's coaching style perhaps doesn't mix with the superstar element of LeBron James, and it's just tough luck? Are we questioning his ability as an NBA coach? Because he is a relatively new and inexperienced NBA coach.
I think a little bit of both. I think there is some questioning of his ability as an NBA coach, because you take LeBron off that team, he's not going to have that record, of course. And I think that there's also, you know, maybe the way he communicates with players, the respect level they have for them. As you know, in highest of level of sports, professional sports, guys have, you know, certain respect levels for guys that have been around this game and played this game. And, you know, David Blatt had never been a coach in the NBA. He had never had a proven track record. He was kind of unknown. And yeah, you bring LeBron James, and that's a great point you just made. Like, maybe after they got LeBron, everything kind of changed and they had to go with somebody a little bit different. So I don't know if David Blatt's going to get another job in this league as a head coach, and that might tell you how he's thought of around the league as a head coach.
Now, we've seen the Panthers, for instance, this season in the NFL playing with a lot of this buzzword at the moment, swagger. And it's something that's been mentioned about the lack of it in this Cleveland offense that's only ranked about 16th in the NBA at the moment. Is that what a new coach needs to bring into now, into this Cleveland side, just a confidence? Does Lou just need to get this side playing with a little bit of kind of that chip on their shoulder, a bit of swagger, a bit of confidence, a bit more showboating, if you will?
I think what it comes down to is, you know, what I referenced with the running and getting out in transition and attacking the rim a little bit more. And when you have a player that's as great as LeBron James, who's physically, I think, he's the hardest matchup in any sport. He's so physically dominant. He's so much bigger and faster and stronger than pretty much anybody he will go against. And then you have a great point guard in Kyrie Irving. I think you got to allow those guys to be athletes, to play the way they're supposed to play. And I think so far it's been, you know, proving that you see them play so far, this is the type of team they want. And that is the swagger, I think.
Had that big win against the Timberwolves in Tyronn Lue's first game in charge of the Cleveland Cavaliers. Sal, we know we've got to let you go because you're a very busy man indeed, but appreciate you covering all things North American sports for us today, man.
I appreciate you guys having me on. Thank you very much.
Always a pleasure, mate. Always a pleasure. Big thanks to Sal Capaccio there for joining us. Gents, we're going to move back a little closer to home, although not too close, because let's dive into a little bit of Australian Open tennis. Johanna Konta, the British ladies number one, only broke into the top 100 last year, planting herself in the semi-finals of the women's draw. After all that's been going around the ATP, the match-fixing scandal in the last few weeks, gentlemen, this is big just to detract away from that and start talking about action on the tennis court as opposed to off it.
Is that British ladies in the same way that Greg Rosiewski was British male, Ollie?
I was wondering if you were going to go on the imports Australian-born Hungarian parents route there, Paul. Yeah.
What a massive stereotype you are, Paul. You're kicking up about English defining English tennis.
Yeah, I know, exactly. No, yeah, I mean, it is a bit of a, it's an interesting story. She has come from nowhere. A bit of an unlikely run to this stage of the tournament. I'm going to put my cynical hat on again and say it's probably more to do with the weakness of the women's game in tennis at the moment than it is to do with Korda's achievements, as good as they are. I think if you look at Serena's performance against Sharapova, who's still ranked number 5 in the world, she brushed her aside 6-4, 6-1 yesterday. She's still far and away the best women's tennis player in the world. And the particularly at the quarter-final stage of any kind of recent majors, the last 8 women, with exception of Serena, seem to be pretty interchangeable. There's not too much between, say, the top 40 and 50 women in the world. And that's not to suggest that all of them are a really high standard. I just think there's been a regression further down the women's game in tennis that leads to situations where Korda can go on a run like this. She's done really well. She's got a game against Gerber, the German, in the semi-final for a shot at Serena in the final. But I wouldn't give her much hope against Serena, to be honest.
I don't think anybody's got any hope against Serena in the women's game at the moment. And perhaps a slightly fortuitous run, aside from the win against Venus Williams in the opening round, she's only had to face one other ranked opponent in Makarova, who is ranked 21st in the seeding for this tournament. It's been a bit of a lucky run as well with who she's had to face, Kristen.
It is. You can only beat the players that are put in front of you, though. I think it's a tad harsh on her to diminish her achievements because people feel she hasn't had a better quality of opponent. I think she'll only grow from facing someone like Serena anyway. So there's a lot of positives for her to take, and I do feel a tad sorry for her. I'm not sure if I necessarily agree with Paul's assessment. I think if so many of the players are interchangeable, surely that talks to a better level of competition amongst the group. It may not be as high comparative to years gone by, but then it's impossible to truly characterise how much stronger tennis was 10, 15, even 5 years ago. So I think we have to take her achievements for what they are, which is impressive relative to kind of the meteoric rise of things. And I hope for her sake, at least, it's the first of many things that she manages to achieve in the game.
More interesting than the men's game, which of course has got those big 3 in the top 4 spots in the semi-finals at the moment in Murray, Djokovic and Federer.
The difficulty I have with that comparison is when the women have the same infrastructure, then we can compare whose is more interesting. Realistically, the men's game has consistently for decades now had a lot more of the money, the share, the prize money, all that stuff, the marketing. So it's always going to look better. It's a prettier dress package.
But you also know that those 3 are probably going to be in the final 4 of almost every major tournament in tennis right now, unless the draw throws them all together at some point earlier on. I just think it's a little too predictable still, the men's game. You know it's probably going to be Djokovic or Federer winning, perhaps if Murray can get an outside chance as well. Let's move away from the tennis and move to our bread and butter, the English Premier League, of course. And let's take a little moment to appreciate Dele Alli's strike from the weekend. A magnificent goal. Some have said he's showing signs of a young Paul Gascoigne. Some have saying he's already on that level. What is Dele Alli's kind of stratosphere that he can reach right now? How high and how far can this kid go for both Tottenham and for England? Or do we need to perhaps rein ourselves back in and start remembering that he is still a youngster and he's only played 21 games in the Premier League in his career?
It's just not in the nature of English people, even English culture, to try and rein someone in when they're proving themselves capable of becoming a superstar. I think that's a real issue, Ollie. I think we've seen it in numerous times over the years with Owens and Rooney's and the likes. And having seen Ali a few times this season, I think he's got the potential to join that group in terms of where he could go in the game. I think Spurs have managed his trajectory to the top level to perfection, sending him down through the divisions there on this corner at MK Dons and then bringing him back up and putting him straight in the team. I think he fits perfectly with Pochettino's philosophy there. And I think he can play in any one of those roles in midfield. I think if they wanted to turn him into a defensive midfielder, he'd be capable of doing that. I think if they want to make him that offensive midfielder, the 10 off a striker, he's already proven himself massively capable of doing that. And I think he could even play up front. I think he's that good. I think he's that multi-talented and has so many facets to his game that really he could go anywhere. And I don't want to stretch here and say that England have got a chance of winning Euro 16 because I don't think they do. But I don't think the talk from certain quarters that it could be doom and gloom and another quarter-final exit are quite all there. I think Hodgson is building a pretty decent young team here. And while this tournament might not be the one for them, I think England could have a really solid side by the time the World Cup comes around.
Is Paul broadcasting live from Hadrian's Wall? He seems very eager to smash England every chance he gets. I do agree with it to a degree. That what I would say is that we have to take any expectation off the young lad. He's 19. I think you have to let him grow in an organic way and let him develop at his own pace. That's part of the problem that England have got. It's far too talismanic. Too often they hang their hopes on one player and expect that player to lift the rest. You have to build a strong team. You look at all the teams recently that have won the World Cup and the European Championships. It's been born on the idea that the group is the biggest concern, not the individual. And when you start to cater and pander to the individual, I think you actually cause yourself a lot more trouble and problem in terms of trying to foster a team ethic. So I think saying what he can achieve, I think he can achieve whatever he is willing to sacrifice in terms of whatever commitment he's willing to give the game, he will make that achievement. We've seen numerous players. Jermaine Jennis is probably quite a decent example. He was heralded in a similar light, coming up from a lower league. Didn't quite achieve what he needed to, was also unfortunate with injuries. But I think we need to stop deciding Dele Alli's future for him and just let him approach it at his own time as it comes to him naturally.
Do you think he's in almost the perfect side to build his own career? Because this Tottenham side isn't predicted to win titles, although they are, you have to say, in the title race at this point. And they are just ticking along and getting a real chemistry together. And Dele Alli is a key part of that.
I think he's got the right balance of pressure and freedom, in the sense that playing for Tottenham comes with a pressure to it, because again, you've got to battle against Arsenal, you've got to face those rivals. But equally, as you say, they're not expected to win the title. Anything they achieve outside of Champions League is seen as a success.
It'd be interesting to see how Tottenham do as they kick on in this second part of the season, but they are right in that title race, as are Arsenal, who had that disappointing loss to Chelsea on the weekend. Down a man, of course, after Per Mertesacker sent off in the first half and Diego Costa punishing them. Manchester United were disappointing as well on the weekend. Charlie Austin with his first goal to Southampton to sink United at Old Trafford. And Everton too, losing to Swansea. Plenty of disappointing performances from these three sides. Which is the most disappointing in grand schemes of this season? Because many will say that Arsenal should and could be running away with the title right about now. Many will say United should have themselves in top four position. And many will say that Everton are completely underachieving this year.
It's difficult to say which one's the worst. Personally, my opinion is that if Arsenal and Wenger don't win the league this season, I think Wenger's got to ask the question of when he's going to win it. Because Arsenal have been able to retain all of their inconsistencies and their idiosyncrasies this season and still be in with a shout. Now, if you'd have given Wenger this position they're in at the moment, 3 points behind an outsider like Leicester at the start of the season, he'd have taken your hand off. What Arsenal need to look at now is, have they got the mentality to turn this situation into a positive one and take it on from here? Now, they've got an extremely tough run of away fixtures coming up over the next few months. Has that team got the ability to knuckle down and actually go and win these games away from home when it really counts? Because Manchester City at the moment don't have that mentality without Vincent Kompany in the team. And it's up to Arsenal to prove that they do.
But Arsenal consistently prove that they don't have that, because it's always this time of year that they end up stumbling and slipping up against lesser sides. And as you say, they've got this tough run of games coming up at the moment. It's only going to get harder for them at a crucial point of the year.
But with the exception of maybe 2008 and I think maybe 2010, they were already out the picture by this point in the season. The likes of Chelsea or City or United were well clear. They've managed to make all those same Arsenal-esque mistakes this season and yet are still in with a shout. That's the thing that must be so frustrating for Arsenal fans, is they're being peak Arsenal at the moment, but yet they're tormenting their fans so much because they know that they're still in with a real good chance of winning this. Because Manchester City's away form is awful. Aguero aside at the weekend, they were massively outplayed by West Ham and were lucky to get a point. So it's still within their grasp. It's just whether they want to be Arsenal or whether they want to be title winners, because the two aren't interchangeable.
What about on Merseyside and Roberto Martinez? Because pressure is mounting on him now. He's always got an excuse. He's never slamming his side and saying that they didn't perform well enough. But losing to strugglers Swansea, and with Klopp pulling that 5-4 out of the bag and then putting his Liverpool side in the Capital One Cup final on penalties last night as well, Liverpool are just getting an end product to their hard work, even if there's not much quality to it, whereas Everton have got this really solid group of players that are really underperforming with them sat in 12th at the moment.
Three wins in September and they've all come against teams in the bottom three. That tells you the story, I think, in itself. It's not good enough. And we're seeing a similar trope to what played out with Wigan and Roberto Martinez. They play pretty football, it doesn't achieve much. The difficulty, or the difference rather, that he had at Wigan was they were consistently selling his best players, and I think he could kind of escape into that, and you could argue the lack of consistency of squad almost negated the fact that they struggled. They did eventually go down under him, which I think is important to remember as well. Mm. He's got a bit more stability here. I think personally the reason they brought him in was because he could seemingly handle those constant squad changes, which is something that Everton are also liable to in terms of having to sell their best players. It's just not good enough. I think he has to be a lot more flexible. I think he's trapped in his own bubble.
Martinez, though, does have the reputation still of being a guy who's plays at least wonderful football and has his own system on a side, and I just wonder if that's what's helping him at the moment, because that's what he did at Wigan. At least they went down playing attractive football, and I think everybody believes obviously Everton aren't a side that can go down, but are they actually defensively solid enough?
On that one, Ollie, just before we finish, I mean, you've got two immensely talented players there, then Ross Bartley and John Stones. Are they going to kick on to the level that their careers desire and that England probably desires whilst playing in this underachieving Everton team? It's another question to ask yourself.
Well, and you compare it to what Dele Alli's doing in that Tottenham side as well at this point in time. Gents, we are going to have to leave it there. Massive thanks to Sal. A big thanks, of course, to Kristen for his third appearance on the show. And, of course, Paul, pleasure to talk to you as always. Remember to catch us on Twitter at 20MinuteHit. That's at 20MinuteHit. And, of course, subscribe to us on the iTunes Store as well. We'll be back in 7 days' time. Until then, have a good one.